Hello, and welcome to Stories of the Journey Home. This is Leo Sofa. Now, once upon a time, there was a stallholder named John. And John was always in the marketplace and he was always selling his stuff. And there was something about John that was unusual, which is that whereas the other stallholders were predictable in what they sold, John was erratic. John was unpredictable and would always have something on his stall that you'd never seen before. People would know what they were getting when they went to that guy with his vegetables and that guy with his spices, but with John you never knew. And the peddlers, who went from town to town, to village to village with their stuff, with their stock, with whatever it was that they'd managed to find out there in the world, they knew this about John, and they knew that if they had something a little bit quirky, a little bit unusual, they could always go to John and he'd have an open ear and a welcome for whatever weird object or artifact or strange stock that they had to give him. And they would usually be able to sell it to him for a decent price. And John's customers knew him well, and so on it went. John was always the strange corner of the market, and people loved him for that. Well, this was a kind of creative thing when he was a young man and just beginning his career. It was kind of like an itch, sort of like a creative itch of like, well, what would be the next weird thing to sell and how can I be open to whatever's coming next? But as he approached midlife, why, it started to be more like a scratch for John, more like something that he couldn't quite reach, like he couldn't quite get to and scratch to his satisfaction. It was becoming something that he had impatience for, a sense that there was something he hadn't quite got yet. Until one day, it really just came to a point for John. He started to get this sense, there's something I haven't sold yet, but I'm supposed to have sold by now. There's something I'm supposed to be selling on my market stall, but it just hasn't come my way, but I know it's there. I just know it's there. I know it's got my number. I just don't know how to receive the information. So now when the peddlers come, he examines very closely what it is they have. And more often than not, he actually sends them away. He's looking for something now, you see. He's looking for this specific thing that he was supposed to be selling, but he hasn't found yet. And now it starts to become something that you could say haunts him. Something that always is calling his name and yet whenever he turns around, there's nothing there. He starts trying to catch it unawares. He starts sitting by the river and just letting himself drift into a reverie. Or it's when he's fallen asleep. Those are the moments. Something will come. Something will come, even just for a microsecond, like a clarity of the thing I'm supposed to be selling. It's beautiful, but you can never set eyes on it. Or the thing I'm supposed to be selling. Why, it's awesome, but you've no idea how to describe it. The thing I'm supposed to be selling, why? And on it would go like this. On it would go like this until it would tax his brain, till it would seem like some riddle that life was setting him and that he just couldn't work it out. It's as big as a mountain and yet so tiny you could fit it under your fingernail. Falling asleep. Drifting off by the river, walking in the woods and entering into a reverie, John became quite clear that there was something he was supposed to not be selling but to be given. Not to be selling but to be given, like it was supposed to just be coming through him, but he still didn't have a clue what it was. Until, why, John He decides that he has enough now of waiting. He's had enough of just biding his time and hoping life will come and hand it to him. No. Instead, he's going to take matters into his own hands. And now he just sits. He just sits at his stall. And it's like he's saying to life, you got to show me now. Life, you got to show me. What is it I'm supposed to be given here? And he doesn't buy anything new. He just sells down his stock. He doesn't buy anything new, he just sells down his stock. And he knows that starvation is waiting. He knows that poverty is banging on the door when everything's gone. But John, he's staring life down. He's daring life to show him what he's here to give. And people come to his rapidly emptying stall and they say, as people would be expected to say, what are you selling here, John? It looks like nothing. And John just stares at them. He says, yeah, of course it's nothing. Soon there's absolutely nothing on his stall. John, what is it you're selling? Looks like nothing. Yes, he says, that's right, nothing. Because he's taken now to simply saying yes to everything. You know, he's just going to say yes to whatever it is that comes along, whatever strange occurrence happens in his life, whatever question he's asked. John's decided now he's just going to say yes. So soon the market stalls are buzzing, and soon the whole market's buzzing with people saying, have you heard? Have you heard? John, he's gone a little bit crazy. In fact, we really should be calling him Crazy John, because have you heard, he's not selling nothing. He's selling absolutely nothing on his stall. I mean, he must have somehow come across some kind of magic trick, because who would pay anything for nothing? Or those slightly less sympathetic to the poor man might be saying, John must be in league with the devil. He must be in league with the devil because he must have found a way of tricking people out of their money. He's selling nothing, and still people are buying it. What kind of a stallholder is that? Well, soon the rumours are making their way around the marketplace. Crazy John, as now everyone's calling him, Crazy John is selling nothing. And soon the local constabulary, they feel they ought to let the palace know that something is a little bit suspicious in the marketplace, and perhaps the palace want to check it out for themselves. And so the royal spies are sent down and they do their nosing around and asking their discreet questions, to which John simply says yes, because that's all he says. Even though he can see that he's going to get himself into trouble, he just says yes. Even though these guys in disguise are quite clearly the palace spies, he says yes to their rather stupid questions. And so now the Chamberlain gets to hear about it, and he's scratching his head and thinking, well, it's not really something I want to bother the king with, but it is causing a bit of a commotion down there. And so at the end of one of their morning meetings, the Chamberlain, he kind of ums and he ahs and he huffs and he puffs, and he says, just one last thing, Your Majesty. I don't like to bother you with trivial things, but this is causing a little bit of unrest down in the marketplace. You see, there is this chap. Yes, says the king, already feeling impatient with this. Is it called John? Crazy John, they call him. I don't know if that's a yes, says the king, clearly quite impatient. They say that he's selling nothing, Your Majesty. And so, says the king, quite clearly at the limit of his patience, what's wrong with selling nothing? And with that, he turns around and dismisses the Chamberlain And the Chamberlain is left wondering if he and the King quite properly understood each other, but the moment has come and gone, and the King has said what he said, and that was the end of it. So now the palace spies are told to go and tell the constabulary to not bother with John and leave him in peace because the King has said so. And so now that the King has apparently given his blessing to John's antics, his antics become the topic of a rather more refined kind of gossip in the marketplace and in the town beyond. The well-to-do at their fine dinner parties, who don't really have much else to talk about except tittle-tattle and gossip, they find themselves talking about John. And the more educated of them, or those who like to think that they are and would like others to see them in that light, they start philosophising in a rather kind of roundabout way about how a man could be selling nothing, what that might signify, and, oh, it's all very jolly and pleasant. And in the midst of it, there's a man who has no time for philosophy and yet is desperate for an answer to a most pressing problem. And that is a Lord So-and-so whose daughter, a Lady Susan, has been suffering from melancholia for a very long time. Indeed, all the doctors have come and gone. And when the last one left without effecting any kind of a cure, Lady Susan was heard remarking, "Oh, I don't think anything will cure me. In fact, I believe nothing will cure me." And so when the Lord is sitting at the dinner party and he hears that there's this man in the marketplace selling nothing, it grabs him. It grabs him in the place where his love for his daughter sits, and he walks off to the marketplace the next day. And he finds there John, sitting like a man staring into the headlights of an oncoming car, like a man who's reaching the limits of what he ever thought he could do, like a man who no longer bothers with untruth, even if it kills him. A man who says yes, yes, yes to everything. And so when this Lord So-and-so comes and he's all full of his highfalutin questions about nothing, he says, "Would you possibly, well, you see, it's my daughter." And then the Lord goes on to tell John the whole story, the long and sorry story of Lady Susan and her melancholia and how no one has managed to fix it, and how, well, what she'd said the other day, that maybe nothing could cure her. "And, you know, since you are selling nothing, so I hear, I wondered if perhaps you could help her." And, of course, John, he just says yes, because that's all he ever says now. Just yes. "Oh, marvellous," says the Lord. And now the two of them are off to see Lady Susan. And when they get there and the Lord explains that this chap might be able to help, "I've heard he can actually do something for you, because he's really quite familiar with nothing. And you did say that would cure you, didn't you, darling? You did say that nothing will cure you." Well, Lady Susan can see what's happened, is feeling very flustered. But as soon as her father's gone, she tries to explain things. "Well, you see, it's not quite as my father would have you believe. You see, my melancholia, well, it all started..." And then off she goes. Off she goes into the story that, from her perspective, is even sadder and even more frustrating and even more smothering than it is to her father. She goes on and on talking about what it is she feels must have caused her melancholia, all the various theories that over many, many years of exploring and examining it, she has come to, often with the help of the very fine and well-meaning doctors. And she speaks and she speaks and she speaks. And John does what he always does now. He just watches. He watches her as if he is watching life itself. He's watching her as if he expects that maybe this is how the answer comes to him. Maybe this is what life is trying to tell him. And on his lips, there's almost a prayer of, come, life, come on, show me what it is. Show me what it is I'm supposed to do here. The result being that Lady Susan speaks and speaks and speaks and goes on further and longer than anybody, any of the doctors who've come and tried to help her, any of them have ever allowed her to speak without offering a remedy. And it's something about the speaking to the very end of it that by the time she finishes and she just gazes at John, who is utterly present, with that prayer on his lips of, show me, God, what it is I'm supposed to do. She finds it's had a magical effect upon her. It has this magical effect upon her. It's like she doesn't really know where she is anymore. But she's quite clear that she has not named the root of her melancholia. And she says as much. She said, you know, no one's ever let me speak that long. And I must say now that I believe the problem began much earlier. Yes, it's never been clear to me before, but it is now. I do believe it began when... And then off she goes. Off she goes into the next thing that reveals itself in John's unwavering presence. She speaks this out, and she speaks this out, and John, he watches her like a hawk with the prayer on his lips of, please show me life. I'm ready, I'm waiting, but please show me what it is I'm supposed to give here. And she again, blissfully uninterrupted, she comes to the end of this revelation. And she's almost swooning by the end of it, because having said it all, having spoken it all out without interruption from John, she is quite clear. Right there's a revelation even greater than the one she just spoke. She says, oh my goodness, I can't believe it. But you know what? No one's ever listened to me like this before. And now that I've spoken it all out, I'm quite clear that it was something else, something deeper. The problem began something earlier in my life. It must have been when. And now she's talking all about the very earliest things, about her mother and her father, and the very earliest, most tender places in her. And John, he just listens with the prayer on his lips of, please show me what it is I'm supposed to be giving to life. Show me, God, what it is I'm supposed to be giving. And she speaks it out, and she speaks it out, and she comes, it would seem, to the very bottom, to the very bottom of her melancholia. And what she hits there, why, it sends her shuddering into a volley of tears. It sends her shuddering into a volley of tears that shake her back and shake her shoulders. And she's crying and she's crying, and the tears are running down her cheeks and dripping off the end of her chin. And still, John, he just sits there. And he just watches her, and he says, please, to himself, the prayer on his lips is, please show me what it is I'm supposed to give. And nothing comes, and nothing comes. And so still he sits. He doesn't even offer her a handkerchief, even though there's one right there. He doesn't even offer his sleeve to wipe her tears away. No, he just sits and he waits. Because his question still hasn't been answered. He just watches and he waits. And Lady Susan, why, she's shaking now. She's shaking. And then all of a sudden, she stops. She just stops. And she just gazes at John like something's just bitten her. And John looks at her. And she looks at John. And she said, oh my God, oh my God, there's something I've got to tell you. He just gazes at her. She says yes. In fact, I don't even know what it is I'm supposed to say. I don't even know what this is. I just know how it begins. John wonders how it begins, but he doesn't say anything. Yes, she says. Well, I based on how it begins, I guess it must be a story. But I don't even know what happens next. But I feel like I must tell it to you. And so that's what she does. That's exactly what she does. She tells him a story that begins once upon a time. And that's the story I'm about to tell you. Now, once upon a time, there was a weaver. There was a weaver, and he was very, very good at what he did, a real master of his craft indeed, with all the finest people in the land were his customers. And one time, he's out in the forest, and something very, very unusual happens, because, you know, he's got a tree in the forest that he loves very much, and he was always going there whenever he needs a bit of a break from everything that's going on in his head. You know that kind of a place where you go, where you just want a break from your own mind and from your own thinking? Well, that's what he does. And it's always this tree, a wonderfully old and gnarly, soothing kind of tree. And he would sit with his back against the tree and just let his mind, with all its troubles, just drift away into the middle distance, into the shadows all around, into the forest with its own life, that's utterly, utterly disinterested in whatever's going on inside of his head. There, that's his place of rest. And one time, why, he's sitting under that tree. Yes, he's sitting under that tree, and something very unusual happens. He sees it first out of the corner of his eye. Yes, something silver, something dangling, and when he turns around and looks, what does he see? There's this silver thread dangling down from one of the lower branches of that tree. And he jumps back and he looks at it, and it's most unusual. This thing is like glowing. It's glowing with a light of its own. You can see it especially clearly because that's a very gloomy part of the forest, like I said. And there he is. He's just staring at something that seems to be glowing. And there's no moonlight in the sky that this might be reflecting the light of. There's nothing around. It's like a glowworm has just alighted. But it's not. It's a thread hanging down from the tree. And without really thinking what he's supposed to be doing here, he just grabs it and he rolls it up and he puts it in his pocket as if that were the right thing to do. And he gets up and he walks home, and when he gets home, just to be quite sure that this wasn't a dream, he takes it out and he looks at it, and there it is, still glowing. He thinks, well, that's going to get me in trouble, and he puts it in a drawer and he locks it. But the next time he's out in the forest looking for some solace from his own thinking, he finds himself sitting under that tree, and what do you know? Now there's two threads dripping down, dangling down from the tree, each of them glowing with a light of their own. And once again he's astounded, and he steps back and he just stares at them like he's gazing at some kind of witchcraft, some kind of magic. And without really thinking whether this was the right thing or the wrong thing, he pulls them off the tree, because he's a weaver, you see. He's always looking for thread, nice, fine-looking thread. It's like somehow it's native to him to pull thread. When he sees it, he pulls it off the tree, he rolls it up, puts it in his pocket. He thinks, that's going to get me into trouble. And he walks back home and he puts it under lock and key in that little drawer. Well, this goes on for quite a long time. It does. Until before long, he's got quite a stash there of this strange glowing thread, which doesn't diminish in its glowingness. It just keeps on glowing. He can stash it away as much as he likes, but it keeps on glowing. Sometimes when it's dark and no one's about, he locks his door and he gets it out, to find to his astonishment that those many disparate little threads have woven themselves into something long and singular. And sitting there in the dark while the weaver, he passes it through his fingers and he wonders what kind of thing this is supposed to be for. What kind of tapestry, what kind of cloth this is supposed to be for. And it's not long after this that one of his most pushy and uppity customers comes along, a lord who's extremely considerate, extremely concerned about his reputation, about people coming and enjoying what he has to show. And he says, I need a tapestry. Yes, says the weaver, knowing full well that that's what he normally makes for this customer. I need a tapestry so fine that everyone's going to be talking about it. You see, I've got a ball coming and even the king is going to be there and everybody else. I want them all to love my tapestry. It must be better than anybody else's. I know you work for everybody else. This must be better than everybody else's, even the king's. Can you do it? The weaver, he says, yes, of course. Of course I can do it without really considering the implications of that. Well, yes, of course I can. And then the lord goes away and he's very happy, and the weaver just sits there and he's already got the image in his mind of what he's supposed to make. Often happens like that for him. He just sees it. It's just a lovely tapestry, a good pattern. Yes, he says, I can do that. But when he starts working, something very unusual happens. All the designs, they twist and tangle in his fingers, and nothing comes out right. When he starts working, it's like again and again he must pull apart his own work because the pattern will not come. And each time this happens, why, he knows it's going to get him into trouble, but he can almost hear something inside that locked drawer calling him. He can almost hear something inside the locked drawer calling him. Until, even though he knows for sure this is going to get him into trouble, he pulls out that long thread. And now he can see where that pattern had come from. The pattern that had emerged in his mind shortly after his customer had left. Oh, yes. For it was a medley of dark and light. So fine that you couldn't look at it without being impressed, even though you were a lord with many such things already in your possession, even though you were a king, you could not help but be impressed. And so he sets to working, and his fingers never worked so finely. The thread never flowed so smoothly. That thread from the forest, the one that's glowing, why, it seems to want to find its way through his fingers and into form in that tapestry. Why, it seems to want to make that pattern, that beguiling pattern of light and dark. Yes. By the time he's finished, why, never was there such a most lovely tapestry in all of that kingdom. And when his customer comes and takes it off him, why, he's very, very happy. But he does not appear to notice that there is thread in this tapestry that seems to glow with a life of its own. And it hasn't escaped the thoughts of the weaver that this really is going to be just the beginning of all kinds of trouble, because isn't everybody coming to this party? Isn't the king himself coming? And won't the king sit there and gaze at the tapestry and say to one of his guards, why is that thing glowing like that? Aren't there going to be questions asked of the Lord himself? And those questions won't lead anywhere else but to the weaver. So won't those same guards come knocking on the door within days, with surely by the end of the week? And so he has a kind of hopelessness to him that week, a kind of bunker mentality, sort of counting the food in his kitchen and how he might make an escape. And so, when the ball comes and goes, when the ball comes and goes and still there's no knock at the door, when a whole week has gone by and still no guards have come, the weaver can't believe his luck or can't believe his reprieve. Maybe they're just thinking of something. Maybe they're just cooking up something. Maybe they're going to come anyway. But weeks go by and still nothing. Still no guards. Still no trouble. And it starts to occur to the weaver that maybe he's the only one that can see it. Maybe by some weird quirk, it's simply only him that can see this strange glowing thread. So now when he goes off to the forest and brings back armfuls of the stuff, as it seems to be giving more and more of him whenever he goes out there, when he brings back the armfuls, he just leaves them out in the workshop. He doesn't care if people see them. He just leaves them lying around. And customers come and they go, and nobody says anything. And now it seems to him that really he's the only one who can see it. And a certain boldness comes over him. He starts threading it into this thing and that thing, and maybe this cloth and this carpet and this tapestry. He just starts threading it in, and still nobody notices. Until one day, terrible news sweeps the kingdom. The king is sick with melancholia. And everybody's very concerned about this, because as goes the king, so goes the kingdom. Well, the weaver doesn't think anything about this. I mean, what could he do? But he does nonetheless listen for the anxious gossip that seems to sweep daily through the town. That this doctor has come and then gone again, unable to effect any cure. That now the king is trying all kinds of unusual remedies, and these too have been unsuccessful. Until a kind of hopelessness sets in. People simply saying that it seems like nothing can cure the king. Nothing. And it's just then that one morning the weaver wakes up and he absolutely hates what greets him. Because what greets him is an absolute certainty that he must make a tapestry for the king, and it must be the finest thing he's ever made, and it must be threaded through with that glowing thread. And even though he knows that he might have escaped trouble that time, this time he's absolutely walking into the jaws of it, even then he doesn't stop, because he just knows he has to do it. And so now when he goes out into the forest and when he goes to that tree, why, it is festooned with threads, as if it too had the same idea. Now when he goes out to that tree, it is festooned with threads of many different colours, as if it is almost picking out the design for him. When he gathers them up in his arms, where he struggles home with them, he has so many. It's almost as if when he lays them down on his table, they are already arranging themselves in this pattern that is sublime, sublime, beyond the dreams of even the finest craftsman. When he takes it to the palace, knowing full well that he's walking into the jaws of some unknown danger. He arrives at the gates and the guard says, "What's your business?" And he, with the same recklessness that he's been practicing ever since this awful idea came to him, he says, "I've got a carpet, I've got a tapestry that's going to cure the king." And the guard narrows his eyes and he says, "Oh, right then, well, I've got a pair of socks that will do the same. Go on, get out of here. We've had enough of your sort. Come in here with your fake potions and your magic charms. Go on, go back to where it was you came from and earn an honest living. The king said, no more doctors, no more cures. Go home." And knowing that now he is in the jaws of danger, why should he hesitate? He actually barges the guard out of the way and he runs down the corridor to the great big oak doors behind which he is quite sure must lie the king's throne room. And as he barges through, he finds the king sitting there on his throne and he says, "Your Majesty." Trouble is now all around him. Why should he hesitate? Why should he care for his life when it's already gone? He says, "Your Majesty, I have something that will cure you." And he rushes to the king and he lays the carpet down in front of the king. And the king stares down at this carpet and he stares at the weaver. "Can you not see it, Your Majesty? For all the time that he has been working with this thread, even though nobody else could see it, the weaver could. All the time, whenever he would work with it, whenever it would run through his fingers, why, the weaver would feel the touch of its inspiration. There wasn't a day that went past when just the sight of this thread did not lift his spirits, when working with it in whatever way that he had not sent him into some state of reverie. Do you not see it, Your Majesty?" He felt sure that if nothing could cure the king, why then surely this would be it. The king stared at the tapestry, stared at the weaver, narrowed his eyes. The guard comes barracking down the hallway and bursting into the door and sees that the king is already entertaining this gentleman, and says nothing but stares around nervously at the other guards there, who just nod and say, "Wait. Can you not see it, Your Majesty?"
"See what?" says the king.
"There is such beauty there. Do you not see it?" The king starts to get angry. Something starts to boil inside. Something starts to rise to his throat that is about to bark, that the guards, shuffling already nervously at the door, are to come now and take this idiot out of here, when, knowing full well that it will get her into trouble, but nonetheless speaking up, one of the maids, who was just like dusting something at the side of the throne room, she says, "I can see it." And now everybody turns around. Everybody, even the guards, turns around.
"What?" says the king. "What can you see? Come here."
She comes forward and she looks down at the tapestry and she says, "Oh my God, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. I can see in it somehow, by some magic, by some ethereal light with which it glows, I can see every moment in my life when I was sure of something. Every moment in my life when it was clear to me what was to be done. Every moment in my life when I acted upon a knowing that I just had to do. It's all there. Every moment is right there as if it were written in the threads." The king looked at the weaver. "Do you know this woman?" The weaver shook his head. "Honestly, Your Majesty, I've never seen her before." "Well, then what are the two of you guards?" says the king. And now the weaver thinks, well, that was that.
"Guards, fetch all the servants, everybody, in here now."
Well, that was unexpected, and everybody's gathering now. And the king When they're all there, he says, look and tell me what you see. You. And some people are already crying. And the king can see that they can see it. And when he questions them, where they say things like, I see all the moments when I've really loved somebody, where I've almost had no choice about loving them, where it's just something that's part of my life. I can see all those people there now, all of them. And it reminds me of what I'm really here for.
You, says the king.
And another person speaks up, brushes away the tears, and said, well, I can see all the things that have had real meaning for me, all the things that have lit me up, all the things that have touched me and given me a sense that I'm in the right place at the right time.
Says the king, you.
And on it goes. Until by the end of it, the king is quite clear that this is not a trick, that this is not a hoax. There is simply something here that he cannot see. And so he tells his chamberlain to send out a proclamation all over the kingdom that everybody must come and see the new tapestry that the king has. And there will be tea, and they can get a tour of the palace. So why wouldn't you come? It's nice. It's like a bit of a jolly. People come and they bring their children and they bring their picnics and they all come trooping through the palace. And the king watches them, each one of them, as they troop past. And there are some for whom the tapestry works its magic, and they find themselves crying or gasping or sobbing, whatever it is. They just gaze down and they see it. And these ones the king invites to stay for as long as they like, make their arrangements, tell their relatives they can stay as long as they like. He needs something from them. So by the end of all of that, the king has a classroom. He has a classroom and he the only student, and a classroom filled with teachers. And many of these, all of these, are many ranks below him. Some are even so far that someone he would never even speak to. But now he stands in front of them all and he says, I am your servant. I wish to know what it is you can see. Teach me. And every day there's a class. And everybody, they sit and they listen as one person speaks, gazing into the tapestry and describing what they can see. And the king, he listens and he puzzles it over and he wonders about it and he thinks about all the other things that he's supposed to know in life and all the things he's been taught and all the lessons that he's attended himself and all the learning he did as a young man with the finest tutors in the finest universities, and he tries to work it out and he can't, and it drives him mad. But still, he reconvenes the class every day and he sits and he tries to work it out. And he tries to understand. Until one day when this has been going on for months, he wearily gets himself ready and he pulls on his clothes and he goes down to the throne room, which has now become a kind of revelation chamber, a classroom of insight that he never quite catches. He goes down and people are sweeping and dusting and they're putting out the chairs ready for the day's session. And the king just wanders forlornly past the tapestry. He just glances at it out of the corner of his eye with no sense of trying to understand it. And bam, it's then that it hits him. Why, then it hits him, bang, right between the eyes. And now the king starts to sob and sob and sob. All the people gather round and they say, Your Majesty, what do you see? And very much in the spirit of those sessions, those lessons of revelation, he says what he sees. He sees all the things he wanted to do with his kingdom, but he never got round to them. He sees all the things he wanted to do with his reign, but he never enacted them. He sees all the hopes and the wishes he had as a young man of what he might give to the world, what he might make
of his life at what had been given to him. He sees all of those things, and they are like ghosts from the past. They are like hauntings inside of him, and that is where his melancholia had started. And by a series of questions and investigations, it is discovered that the melancholia that the king had been suffering from, why, it started the night that he attended the ball at the mansion of the lord who had ordered the tapestry from our friend the weaver, and seeing it upon the wall, something had been stirred, and it had been what he had just spoken of, all those things that had stirred inside of him and caused his melancholia. And when this is finally clear, the king's voice rings out, "Get me the weaver!" And the weaver comes through the crowd, and the king tells him exactly what he needs to do. Why, yes, a band of pickers is assembled, and carts too. Carts and horses and men sent off into the forest. And the weaver's been gone so long that now that tree is almost entirely covered in threads. It takes all those men hours and hours of clambering in all its branches to pull down all those threads. But they are of so many different colours. It is as if the tree knows what it is meant for. When the weaver returns, the king tells him what must be done. And he sets him up in a workshop of his own, with all the help he needs. And what does he do? He spins that thread into something so fine that before long he has miles and miles of it, enough length to weave it into the clothes that he then makes for everyone in the kingdom. Why, from the babies all the way up to the elders, everybody gets a piece of clothing from the king, which they wear with pride. Yes, they do. And just wearing one of those pieces of clothing, why, it becomes clear to you what you were here for, what you were supposed to do, how you might do it. Yes, all of that becomes clear. And there was never a more happy, a more settled, a more refined, a more purposeful place in all the world. And Lady Susan, why, she comes to the end of her story. She comes to the end of her story and she grabs John by the arm and she says, "I know what we need to do. Come with me." And she's going downstairs with him and she's getting the carts ready and the horses. And she's hitching everything together and she says, "I know where we need to go. We need to go to the forest." He said, "Look, that was just a story. What are you doing?" She says, "If there's one thing you ever say yes to, even if this is the last thing you say yes to it now. Come with me." And of course, what does John say but yes? And so into the forest they go. Into the forest they go with a couple of horses and a cart hitched up behind it. And he's saying, "Where are we going?" And she's saying, "I don't know, we haven't found it yet." And she steers it right and she steers it left and she steers it wherever she feels like the horse's ears are twitching in the right direction. And she steers it for days and days and days and nights and nights. And it's the nights that are the sweetest. It's the nights that waking from which they find themselves in each other's arms that are the sweetest part of that long meandering journey through the forest. Until at last, They come to a tree, to an apple tree, in full bloom, blossoms everywhere, just like every other tree in the forest, but with a striking difference that this apple tree also has fully ripe apples upon it. And she squeals with delight, and she jumps off the cart, and she pulls him down off it, and she runs beneath it and spreads open her arms, and she says, "Marry me, and then we can truly do what we came here to do." And he just laughs as he wanders towards her and puts his arms around her. He says, "Marry you? Are you crazy? Can you just imagine what they'll do to us, what they'll do to me? I can't marry you." She says, "Damn them all, marry me anyway." And John stares into her eyes, and he realizes that actually those are the eyes that he's been staring in all these months. Those are the eyes that he's been staring in, wishing, praying, begging life, daring life to tell him what it is he's here to give. And he says the word, "Yes." And when he does that, why, a miracle occurs. All those apples, those prematurely ripe apples, they all fall to the ground, thudding to the ground. And the two of them run around laughing and catching, and some of them even land in their hands. But all of them, they pick up from the floor and they put in the cart and they ride back home. And Lady Susan is quite clear what needs to be done with them. For John's stall is now a place you can go and receive one of those apples. And I do believe that every person that got an apple from that place, they would know their purpose. They would know why they were here on this earth. One bite and it would be rippingly clear, grippingly clear to them. And most days John would just sit and watch as his wife Lady Susan would do most of the chatting and most of the selling. He would sit and watch, and it seemed to him that his life's purpose was just unfolding with a life of its own. Even when there was work to do, going back to the tree and finding more of those apples miraculously, hanging there, whatever state the tree was in. Even when there was work to do, why, it seemed like it just happened through him. Like all he had to do was stay right here. Right here. And everything that needed to happen would happen just through him. And I was there. I was. Just wandering up to that place. Wondering about my next story. I saw a bit of a crowd around that stall. I said, "What's the story here?" And everybody told me about the apples and told me that your purpose would be revealed when you had one of those. And I thought, well, that'll do, because I've been lost for years. I haven't really known what to do with my life. I've been telling these stories, but I don't really know what they're for or who they're for or what they're really about. Oh, I've been so lost. And I was thinking about this all the way, thinking about it so hard that I actually bumped into the stall and knocked an apple off it. And Lady Susan, she turned round, she looked at me and she said, "You, I know you. Where have we met before?" I said, I don't quite know, but I did. She said, "Oh, you're the storyteller, aren't you? Why, you're the storyteller." I said, "Listen, don't blame it on me. I was just following instructions." She said, "Oh, no, there's no blame here, but you've got this apple in the wrong part of the story." And she thrust the apple into my hands. She said, "Eat it." Well, a lady like that, you don't disobey. I took a bite, and all at once the story came to me. Why, all at once the story came to me, from the beginning all the way to the end. She said, "Right then, now you've got it in the right place." I said, "I'm so sorry, I must have just got ahead of myself." She said, "Now don't do it again." And she sent me packing. She sent me packing, and
I was always quite confused about that story, how it came in the wrong place and how indeed it did turn out. But I was very happy with the apple because it tasted very good. You know, when you get an apple that's like, oh, tasty, you know, like fruity and not too sour and not too sweet, but with a nice bite. Oh, I was very happy with that apple. Happy happle with that apple. Yeah, I was happle with that apple. And before long, it was gone. Just gone. I don't know quite when. It was just gone. I finished it. I looked down and I didn't have it anymore. And it's a bit like that with this story. Before I knew it, all the words had just gone. Just run out. Just disappeared. Until the very last one, why it left my lips just now.